Oh, good morning. A few more of you are awake. Hopefully, as you came in, you were able to get a handout. And if you didn't, if you would maybe just signify that, it seems like the men are ready to give you one. And because a family emphasis was on tap here for the weekend with the marriage retreat, I thought at least in the morning hour here in Sunday school, we would kind of extend that a little bit and do it in a parenting direction. But maybe at the outset, it would be helpful just to broaden that and think of even what we're going to talk about in terms of discipleship. You may not have children in your home at this point, but we all still have responsibility to be disciple makers. And everything that I say here about parenting could be applied very naturally to the one who is engaged in making disciples. So if you look at the title, I just say that rearing children wisens parents. Okay, modified if you wish, making disciples wisens disciple makers. And wisens, we don't normally use as a verb, but it's just, in this sense, it's a verb, it's designed by God to put pressure on us to grow so that we become wiser in the ways of God. So it's how God helps parents or disciple makers to see their own need for spiritual discernment. And I've penned Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, and then some verses later in the passage, and that's a very familiar passage to most of us. Verse 5, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge, know God, and he will direct your paths. The passage goes on to extol wisdom. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gets understanding. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. They will be life to your soul, adornment to your neck. Solomon is all about urging us to get wisdom, and with all you're getting, get understanding. And in the providence of God, he positions us and gives us duties in the faith that are designed by him to make us grow in wisdom, to make us see our need for it, to hunger for it, and then to pursue it with all of our ability. And making the application here to parenting, I just want to say at the outset that what I'm going to share is somewhat testimonial, and but I don't try to represent myself as an authority. I, too, am just a learner, and God has put me in my own laboratory to work on me. And he's given me a home. He's put me in a ministry context. And both of those settings are designed by God to customize his work in my own heart. So I don't come, as I mentioned in the notes, as one trying to bear testimony to a personal sense of achievement, but really with a sense of gratitude that God does help. He does give you wisdom when you ask for it. And in the New Testament, we learn that he gives it lavishly. He's willing to do that if we're that hungry for it. And I'm thankful that by God's grace, there yet appears for me still time and opportunity to continue to grow. But I do just want to say I love being a dad. It is one of my favorite things in all the earth. My kids have given me two t-shirts through the years. And one of them said, fatherhood, the toughest job you'll ever love. And I just wore that shirt out. I wore it every time we would do something together as a family. And I think it started to embarrass them that I would wear that shirt. And so they bought me a new one. This one says, Dad, the toughest job you'll ever love. And so I have enjoyed this particular school the Lord has put me in. I don't think I could probably say that about every school the Lord has put me in, but this one I have. And maybe four introductory statements about home, both parenting and marriage, and again, make the application more broadly to disciple making. But our homes specifically, I believe it would be accurate to say that there's hardly any arena more under spiritual attack today than the home. We see this on nearly every hand, and for Christian people, it almost doesn't even need any long argumentation to support this. But we see it in society. We actually see it sometimes in ministries where there's so many demands on people that there's not enough attention or time given to strengthening the home. A second observation is that there's no arena that provides more opportunities for the advance of God's kingdom. This is of God's design. But He puts into the hands of parents the opportunity to produce godly seed, a godly family. And moms, you are on the front lines of that battle. And you are engaging in work that is dear to the heart of God. It really is the ideal forum for discipleship. If you led someone to the Lord, you might try to engage in discipleship with them and meet with them once or twice a week for an hour or two at a time. But what if they moved into your house and began to live with you and watch you and listen to you and eat with you? Well, that's what you have in a home. It is an ideal forum for discipleship. And in the providence of God, even when He is giving to His body, the church, instruction about appointing or selecting her leaders, He admonishes them to look at the home. If a man, a woman are leading their children rightly together, if their home is following the Lord, God says, well, that is a helpful qualification if someone is going to be put in charge of leading my people. And what's true at the pastoral level is true at every level of opportunity within a ministry. A third observation then is there's no arena where what you choose to do is so important. And the corollary then, the fourth observation, there's no arena in where what you choose not to do is so vital. And sometimes we don't, you know, we make deliberate choices not to do certain things. And there are sometimes it's by default that we don't do certain things. But what is absent from my home often influences my family just as much as what is present in my home. And we have responsibility, again, whether disciple-making or whether involved in parenting, to make wise choices about what we include and even what we leave out. Now, when I think about parenting specifically, there are four things that almost instinctively, spontaneously come to my mind. And one of those was a conversation that I had with a man now about 10 or 12 years ago. I was working with him on a project, and he started talking with me about a habit that he and his wife have every day. They have lunch together, and they talk about their home. And they had four children given to them by the Lord, and all four of their children walked away from the faith. This was a man, by all accounts that I knew, he was a godly man. And he had attempted in his own way to do well for the Lord, teaching his children. But they had independently made choices in their hearts to walk away from the way in which they had been raised. And so every day at lunch, he and his wife would have these conversations lamenting the loss of their children. And when I heard that, my children were much younger, and you know, that has just sort of haunted me, okay, the possibility that that could well happen in my own home. And all of my actions needed to be geared toward, by God's grace, trying to see that prevented. The second of the haunting realities is my own youthful experience. I think maybe many of you could testify, as I can, that the days of our youth were indeed treacherous days. Not necessarily that we sinned as much as we could, but the potential, the pivotal moments, the poor choices. And I've listed a handful of citations there. Samuel Rutherford, some of you are familiar with that name. The Sands of Time Are Sinking, that hymn is taken from words that he wrote in letters to his church people. And he, in one of those letters, he says, "Youthfulness is a glassy age when Satan finds a swept chamber and a garnished lodging for himself and his train." I mean, I know in my own experience it was a treacherous time. In another letter, he says, "I must first tell you there is not such a glassy, icy, and slippery piece of way betwixt you and heaven as youth." And then Philip Henry, the father of the English commentator Matthew Henry, he said, "It's not possible for you to know till experience teach you how dangerous a time youth is." And we have young people who are here with us today, and to one degree or another, you're right inside of this. It is a dangerous, slippery time. And these men, even from 3 and 4 centuries ago, are saying this is how it was even in our day. It's nothing new. In fact, in today's era, it may even be more treacherous and more slippery. The third of the haunting realities is just the experience I had in growing up. My parents, my dad was a first-generation Christian. He was doing the best he could to try to rear us for the Lord. And we had friends who were close to our family. We would spend a lot of time at their homes. In some cases, they were people in ministry. My dad, I think, attempted to wisely choose our family friends. And just as we grew up, we saw so many of our peers and our close friends who were in very green pastures end up making choices where they walked away from their parents' discipleship. And I still, to this day, I just marvel that God preserved me, that he preserved my brothers and my sister, and we didn't deserve that. And if you ask my parents, you know, what did you do that kept that from happening? They don't even take any credit for it, because we really recognize that it was a work of God. And we're very thankful, but yet the danger is still there. And then this whole issue that I'm talking about really is a historical phenomenon. This is true in every era. The difficulty of producing, discipling a next generation that is going to love God as much or more as the present generation has always been there. And if you think back even to the early days of our country, when the pilgrims and those who followed after them were coming to America, they weren't just pilgrims because they were moving around geographically. They were wanting to live for another kingdom and do so by faith. And so they brought their children and families here to America. And they were establishing colonies in the 1620s and 1630s. But it really wasn't long at all before they were recognizing that even here in America, they were losing their children. Okay, that was the problem that drove them here. And even relocating, even to some degree isolating, they still ended up facing that battle and in many cases losing that battle. So the first thesis, so to speak, that I'm just going to try to hurriedly go through here is just to say that parenting, or again, disciple-making, is designed by God as the means by which we train up our physical children or spiritual children to maturity. And if we think about what maturity really is, okay, that what I'm going to suggest is that we think of maturity as the skill of judging well. Okay, the Bible would use the term discernment, or Proverbs would use understanding that goes together with wisdom. And the paragraph underneath, the aim of parenting or discipleship is not conformity for my children, but character. It's not protection or professionalism, but spiritual progress. And to a great degree, their character and progress is measured by their ability to discern well. And I'm just going to try to draw this out scripturally. Okay, it's not just a point that's sort of arbitrarily made. But when children can grow to discern for themselves between good and evil, that's a Bible objective. That's one level of maturity. And you see the passages that I've listed there. Paul talks about spiritual infants that are growing into spiritual maturity, to where they come to a point where they are truly furnished. Paul also in 1 Corinthians 3 talks about being able to move from a diet of milk to a diet of more solid spiritual food. Romans 14 and verse 15 talks about growing from being weak to being strong, from being children to those who have their senses exercised to discern between evil and good. You see the passage cited there in Hebrews 5, verses 12 through 14. Growing in maturity, one level of that is being able to discern between good and evil. But that's not the only kind of discernment. Paul also is going to talk about other forms of discernment. Many of you know the passage, the prayer that Paul prays in the book of Philippians. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment, that you may approve things that are excellent. And what he's talking about there is that foremost in his mind as he's praying for believers to mature is that they learn to discern or distinguish even between excellent things. Okay, to look at two choices, and while both may be good, to be able to discern which is the better even of those good choices. So often, maturity ends up being demonstrated. You have discerning between good and evil, and there is growth in the ability to discern between better and best. Ephesians 5 and verse 10 is another passage where Paul is going to talk about this concept, and he's urging believers there to grow, to be able to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Okay, think of that. It's not necessarily that everything is black and white. How do I make choices and then choose what I can scripturally have confidence is most pleasing to the Lord? Is it right that there can be degrees of pleasing the Lord? Okay, Paul seems to suggest there is. And then the last of these, and we all want this, Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, where Paul is urging us to not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. And the ultimate goal of that is that we may be able to test out. Okay, again, the idea of discerning, approving, is embedded in that word, but we're able, the more transformed we are, to better ascertain what the good, acceptable, and perfect will of God is for our lives. So this kind of maturity is what we are wanting our children to grow in. And my whole point is that if that's my responsibility, whether it's physical children or spiritual children, that puts a whole lot of pressure on me. I recognize my need then to be discerning if that's something I need to pass on to those coming after me. And that leads to the second of these theses, that for parents, parenting is one of the primary relational processes by which God continues our own maturity, and one of the primary means by which He makes us more discerning ourselves. You know, if you think about it in Scripture, and this is one thing that has just sort of surprised me as I've grown up, God did not give us a book in the Bible that is sort of the parenting manual of the Bible. I think probably all of us wish he did. You know, if he would have thought to do it that way, boy, God, that would have been a wise thing to do for us. But I think it's actually his wisdom that he did not do so. Because the fact that he did not do so actually forces us to grow in the way that he wants us to grow. By not providing that explicit manual, everything black and white and formulaic, the second sentence of that next paragraph, he presses us more deeply into growth by giving us the responsibility to exercise discernment for others who are not yet able to exercise it themselves, and to model discernment for those learners, and to actively teach discernment to them. As parents, we come to see more than ever our own need for discernment, and it should burden us then to teach discernment to our children. In parenting and discipling, you very quickly realize you don't have all the answers. You wish you did. And when you are asked good questions, it drives you to learn more. Here's a quotation from Elizabeth Elliot. Many of you know that name. She wrote a great little book, The Liberty of Obedience. And I keep this one close at hand in my library because I pull it off the shelf and I read this page over and over and over again. She says, "It appears that God has deliberately left us in a quandary about many things. Why did he not summarize all the rules in one book and all the basic doctrines in another?" You think, oh, great idea. He could have eliminated the loopholes, prevented all the schisms over morality and false teaching that have plagued the church for 2,000 years. Think of the squabbling and perplexity we would have been spared. And then here's the punchline. And think of the crop of dwarfs he would have reared. You get her point? If God had sort of spoon-fed everything to us, think how stunted then our growth ultimately would be. But instead of producing a crop of dwarfs, spiritual dwarfs, God is wanting us all to grow up into maturity. And this does, so, you know, it counters. I know, growing up, sometimes I would just tell me what to do, you know. And it's like, well, you know, Dad wouldn't do that. I mean, sometimes he would. But sometimes he wanted to sort of give me the parameters and let me sort through than what would actually help me to grow in my thinking. How then is, I mean, if this is so important, and if this is so much on the heart of God, how can we teach discernment? How do we try to pass it along to another generation? How is discernment caught and taught? What are the ways in which we pack and shape our children's discernment filters to reflect that our own filter is also being shaped? And it may help for the remainder of the time to kind of visualize a filter in your mind and just think, what are you going to pack into that filter that is going to be the process through which you work through to right, mature spiritual decisions, or that your children do? One of the ways that God does this for us, and one of the ways that he enables us to teach this to those coming along behind, is by modeling. Okay, we have the opportunity before our children, before those whom we are discipling, to try to model the exercise of spiritual discernment. We're allowing our wife and children, or those who are new to the faith, to see God make me into what he wants me to be. In fact, God says, or through Solomon can say, you know, to my son, give me your heart and let your eyes observe my ways. It's like, watch, and hopefully you'll learn what God is teaching me. And it really is important for for our children and for those whom we are discipling to see that we have a vital relationship with Christ. Nothing, no growth comes independent of that. It isn't a mechanical growth. It's not a formula, but it's a vital connection to Christ. And from that, any spiritual fruit that comes that benefits other people is only possible really through Christ. We have modeling as a possibility. We have very specific, clear instruction. And what we want to do, either as disciple makers or as parents, is we want to find out, what does God want my children or this new believer to know, particularly about himself, and then do our best to make sure that they learn it. Okay, this is what God has been doing from the beginning. This is what he admonished the children of Israel to do, to love the Lord with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. You model that, and then you teach diligently to your children to do the same. God wants them to learn that. And you do so throughout the day. You do so spontaneously. You do so deliberately. Okay, God wants us to be preoccupied with that. And it's not just by giving them instruction, but also by the commands that we give them. And you know the challenge, anytime you give a command, if it just hangs out there without any further explanation and without any enforcement, okay, any reinforcement, then that command doesn't take long for it to not really mean much. So I've specified commands that are taught, emphasized, and enforced. And I think all of us understand that, you know, there are Bible commands that we want to pass along. And then there's another category of commands that we may have that vary from home to home that are just the sort of the commands of everyday life. Like I tell my kids, don't play with doors. Well, I don't have a Bible verse for that. But doors can be dangerous. You know, you chase through the house and slam the door if someone's following you. Well, you know, fingers and heads and faces can be hit by doors. So we're trying not only to teach Bible instruction, but to teach, you know, a legitimate common sense to our children with the force of commands. But probably one of the most challenging things to do with children and with new believers is to help them learn to navigate between the lines of commands. Okay, now I've got a quotation there underneath the heading Proverbs that I want us to read together. And I think if you look at the book of Proverbs through the lens of what this commentator is bringing to our attention, it'll be really helpful for you. He says, there are details of character small enough to escape the mesh of the law. Okay, early in our Bibles, we have the law. Nearly everything is black and white. So you have the mesh of the law. And then toward the end of our Old Testaments, you have the broad sides of the prophets. Okay, he's saying that there are some details of character small enough to escape the mesh of the law and the broad sides of the prophets, and yet they're decisive in personal dealings. Okay, so there are some nuances of life that seem to sort of fall between the cracks. And the book of Proverbs comes along and helps a believer learn how to fill in that mesh, the things that are between the lines. It's a valuable book in that regard. For example, the law may say to love your neighbor as yourself. But what if he's a fool? What if he's a sluggard? What if he's an angry man? What if he's a liar? Well, Proverbs helps you maneuver through some of the variables that may go into obeying a command like that more effectively, in a more customized way. Moving down toward the bottom, I found for our family, another helpful model is the book of 1 Corinthians. And here's what I discovered in going through that book. There are 107 questions in the book of 1 Corinthians. And there are no questions in chapter 13, and there are no questions in chapter 16. So in 14 chapters, Paul trying to teach this congregation of people how to live in a countercultural way. He effectively asked them theologically, scripturally informed questions. And he guides them through wise questions down to commands. And so one of the tools that we found to be helpful is trying to teach our children to be good question askers. Okay, to look at situations and bring to bear and be willing to ask questions and work your way through a matter and use that to help test out what then might be the most mature response. There's a quote, some of you are familiar with Ravi Zacharias, and when I read this years ago, I thought, boy, that's really good. He says, during my graduate studies, I took a course in which half the grade depended on the answers we gave on exams, while the other half was based on the questions we asked in class. The professor was a firm believer in the value of asking the right questions. And if there is a sliver of light in the darkness of this hour, it is the fact that we are asking the right questions. Okay, learning to ask the right questions. Okay, theologically, scripturally informed questions is a helpful way to instruct. A.W. Tozer, in one compilation of his sermons, there's this statement. He says, this is a generation of questions. Everybody seems to have his own question. Questions are important to ask, but it is more important to ask the right ones. A successful lawyer will win or lose a case simply by the questions he asks or does not ask. There's no end to questions, and we can be bogged down trying to answer each and every little one. Finding our way through the maze of questions today is an all but impossible ride. Okay, now that's written back in the 1960s, but that's our objective. If we're going to follow Paul's example, and you think, well, where did Paul get that technique? Well, if you read through the Gospels, the person who asks the most questions is actually the one who knows the most. It's Christ himself, and he too is using questions as a means of teaching, okay, of bringing people to right conclusions. So I want my children, like you do, okay, whether again physical children or those I may be discipling, I want them to learn to follow in my ways. But even more, I do want them to supersede me in their obedience to the Lord. I want them to begin earlier than I did, to understand better, to assess more quickly, to discern more wisely, to advance farther, to be more clean, to have fewer scars, to persevere longer, to be more ready. I want them to be able to stand on my shoulders like I was privileged to stand on my own father's shoulders. And really, this is true whether you had a perfect father or mother or whether they were imperfect. We can learn a lot from what we were privileged to observe in them. And I want my children's obedience to look like mine. Okay, I mean, it would be very complimentary to a parent if his children sort of imitated their ways, especially spiritually. But in reality, you know, I know that in many ways, their obedience to the Lord might actually look a little different in some cases than mine. But if I am effective at teaching them a right scriptural process at coming to decisions, and the reasons for their choices are scriptural, then I think as a parent, I would be happy with that result. It may not be exactly like mine in appearance, but if they're working through it with a scriptural mindset and for scriptural purpose, then I'll be watching discernment at some level on display, working in the hearts of my children. Now, what follows are just a series of illustrations, and we're not going to try to go through all of these. In fact, probably none of them. I think our time is just about finished. But through the years, we've just done different things in our homes, and things that we did at the beginning when our children were little, we needed to do something a little different to build on those things as the years went by. And the simplicity of what we did when they were 3 or 4 needed to be filled out a little bit more when they were 8 and 9 and when they were 17 and 18. And in our situation, we have 4 older kids and then we have 2 younger children. And it's sort of a gift from the Lord to us. We feel like it's an opportunity. I mean, one possibility, we'd forget to teach our younger kids what we hope to teach our older kids. But it's also an opportunity to try to do better with the younger group, even than we did with the older children. And if the illustrations of things that follow in the pages that fill out the handout would in any way be suggestive or helpful to you, I'm not saying use these tools. I'm just setting them as examples as the kinds of things, and if they birth ideas in you for what you can do in your own home, then, you know, then maybe it'll be helpful, and that would be my hope. Okay, I think we're done, right? Good time? All right, let's pray together.